some people back for the first time in a long while. And some old regulars. Venerable. Venerable elders. Oh, so this year at the Santa Cruz Zen Center, we're exploring, amongst many things, the Dharma topic of kindness, compassion, and the altruistic wish to realize complete awakening to be of the most benefit to everyone. So I've been continuing to think about such things. Particularly loving kindness. Metta in Pali, Maitri in Sanskrit. As the foundation of these practices. Sometimes it's said that bodhisattvas who are living to benefit all beings have as their central practice these six perfections, six bodhisattva practices of giving, ethical conduct, patience, vigor, enthusiasm, meditative concentration, and the wisdom which goes beyond wisdom. So they're working on those. One of the ancient commentaries says, while they're working on those practices, they can start to get weary, tired, because it's kind of like an endless process to do these practices. They can start to get tired and also start to get like partial. Like, start really enjoying giving, but just to particular people, maybe. So that's when they use these, we call immeasurables, to kind of like aid and support these perfections of the bodhisattva. The immeasurables are loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. We've been studying in a class too, Asanga's treatise on the three bodhisattva precepts of embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, embracing and sustaining all good qualities, and embracing and sustaining all living beings. And it said that the second one, embracing and sustaining all good, is like these six perfections of the bodhisattva, giving and ethics, patience, diligence, concentration and wisdom. And the practice of embracing and sustaining all beings is these four immeasurables of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So that's one way you can piece these things together, looking at various lists. Also thinking about Maitri, kindness, loving kindness. Does anyone remember the definition we talked about in previous weeks? What's the basic definition of the practice of loving kindness?
You said you were going to test us.
Patrick?
Friendliness.
Friendliness. How would you define friendliness? We could say that it's an attitude. It's a wish. Bodhisattvas have wishes. They don't just like sit there without wanting anything. They want stuff. They have strong desires. And guess what this wish that we call loving kindness is?
To wish that others would be happy.
Yes! There was a hint, but yes. It's the wish, or the strong feeling and intention. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy is kind of like a wish. And now you might be able to guess, remember, what the definition of compassion is.
May all beings be free from suffering.
Yes, may the wish, intention, may all beings be free from suffering. So they're very similar, kindness and compassion. One's like about the happiness, and one's like the freedom from the unhappiness. And they're delineated for certain reasons, which we'll get into. But just taking up this wish that others be happy, and the practice of having that feeling that may all beings be happy, wanting that for ourselves and others, is a very joyful practice. Even just try it out for a second or two, it's quite a pleasant feeling to have such a mind. I was just thinking, I think it's related, this term Kalyana Mitra. Kalyana Mitra is like, Mitra is the same word as Maitri, same root. So yeah, friend, if Maitri is friendliness or kindness, Mitra is friend. Yeah. And Kalyana means like good or admirable friend. Kalyana Mitra, sometimes like, a spiritual teacher, but I think it actually includes spiritual friendship of any kind. Kalyana Mitra Ta is spiritual friendship. The state of being in spiritual friendship with a spiritual friend. So Kalyana Mitra and Kalyana Mitra Ta. So in the early sutras, the Buddha says, what is meant by this admirable friendship, good friendship? There is the case where a lay person in whatever town or village she may dwell spends time with other householders, young and old, who are advanced in virtue. He talks with them, engages them in discussions. She emulates consummate conviction in the principle of cause and effect. He emulates consummate conviction in this principle of karma or cause and effect in those who are consummate in conviction. Consummate virtue. He emulates consummate virtue in those who are consummate in virtue, and emulates consummate generosity in those who are consummate in generosity, and consummate discernment in those who are consummate in discernment. This is called admirable friendship, good friendship. And it's interesting he's talking particularly to the lay people, but I think same practice for the monks, but practice for everyone. Good friendship is spending time with others who are practicing virtue, because it helps us to practice virtue when we spend time with others who are practicing, and talking with them. Buddha sometimes encourages being really silent, but sometimes he encourages people to talk a lot, have lots of discussions. So here at Zen Center, we sometimes sit silently and sometimes we have extensive discussions. And emulates, or, encourages and tries to practice great conviction or faith in the teachings that lead to happiness. Practices virtue, practices generosity, and discernment, some nice practices. Trust in the teachings, virtue, refraining from harming others, generosity and discernment or wisdom. And discussing these things together and practicing them together is what's called admirable friendship. Kalyana mitra ta. So, as related to kindness, it's kind of like for us to practice kindness, it helps to have kind friends, to encourage them, be kind to them, help them practice kindness, and they help us practice kindness. So it's like this, you know, meeting of kind ones. A mitra is friend, but we could say kind ones. We hang out with kind ones who encourage us to practice. And the Buddha says elsewhere, I don't envision any other single factor like friendship with these good friends as doing so much for monks in training who have not yet attained the heart's goal, but they remain intent on finding this freedom from bondage. One who's working on this project of freedom from bondage, but has not yet attained their heart's goal. The single factor I recommend most is friendship with Kalyana Mitras. A monk who's a friend with these admirable friends abandons what is unskillful and develops what is skillful. And maybe the most classic sutra on this you maybe have heard. As he was sitting there, Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, I just had this revelation that half of the holy life is admirable friendship, good companionship, good camaraderie. I just think this is like half of our practice is this good friendship. And the Buddha says, don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life, not just half. When one has good friends, good spiritual friends, companions and colleagues, you can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path. So, we can be good friends for others, and we can spend time talking with and sitting silently with Kalyana Mitras, good friends, to encourage our friendliness and their friendliness. So, the practice of loving kindness, this wish, sometimes we might not feel it, right? And so that's why it's called the practice. We can work on it. We can cultivate this wish, may all beings be happy, to, you know, open and open our heart and bring joy to our whole being and joy to others. And the Buddha offers some practices. As I've mentioned before, the Zen tradition is very like pare down. We just like it's streamlined practice. So we just sit, and it includes all of this. And I'll mention a Zen take on this. On this streamlined version of approaching loving kindness a little bit later. But there are these skillful means, there's these methods, and so these are taught by the Buddha in the early teachings, and practices in the sutras of the Buddha that all traditions of Buddha honor. So I thought this was nice. I had never heard this before. These four different types of methods that you can try out if you don't feel like you have this wish. Or maybe if you don't have this wish towards everyone, there's some people that you just don't care that much whether they're that happy. Maybe you don't even wish them ill will, but you're just like, whatever. We want to like extend this, radiate this loving kindness in the 10 directions and the 6 realms to all sentient beings, visible and invisible, near or far. So to extend it further, even if we already are feeling some of this loving kindness. One of them is the classic one that you hear about more in Tibetan tradition, but I found this in a Theravada commentary from a sutra of the Buddha in the Pali Canon. And it's contemplating, it's this kind of like, it's a conceptual contemplation about how all beings, people but also animals, and if we can relate to beings like hungry ghosts and devas and hell beings, whatever kind of sentient beings there are in all these realms, we envision how they have all been in countless past lives in relationship to us in past lives, in every possible kind of relationship, right? So like they've been our mother, our father, our siblings, and our children. So this the problem with this is it pretty much relies on a pretty strong faith in the teaching of rebirth, which the Buddha taught partly for this reason, I think, so we can think of such things, such vast, interconnected, intimate relationship with all beings through time and space. That's one advantage of this teaching, that we're all being born and dying, and there's no self, but there's continuity. No self meaning like there's no essence of me going through, but there's cause and effect. There's karmic patterns of cause and effect that continue to have effect beyond this life. In particular, streams. So this is teaching in the tradition. And if we go for that story, then it's maybe possible. It's almost like it's a logical conclusion, I think, if we go for that possibility, that in all these infinite, basically beginningless past lives, because there've been so many infinite numbers, we have necessarily been in every possible relationship, just by law of averages, not by coincidence, right? But just we've been enemies too. We've killed each other and loved each other many times over, right? So this is part of this vast, vast view. And but then to like look at any particular person and say, they've killed me and I've killed them, but also they've been my kind mother. They actually like raised me from an infant. This person or this stream of being, something in their heart now is connected to the fact of something in my heart now, that we have this old relationship a long time ago, where they basically like took care of me when I couldn't take care of myself. So that's this. By doing that contemplation, we start to feel this intimacy and love for beings that we feel like not so connected with. It's kind of it's a skillful means. So I just I think in modern times, when this issue of rebirth is a little more controversial, people don't necessarily believe in it just because it's in the sutras. It's one of those things that even the Buddha said, in a lot of teachings you should check out for yourself, but unfortunately this one you can't really check out for yourself unless you have extremely refined kind of psychic powers, which some people say they can develop, where you can either remember or you can go through this process so consciously that you'll remember the next time. But for most of us who can't do that so easily, it occurs to me that, well, can we come up with another skillful means, with to develop this kind of wide relationality of intimacy without rebirth. And another one I thought of, see what you think about this. It's kind of based on this modern view of how we come to be, kind of like Darwinian evolution. And I'll put in parentheses, my understanding is that Darwinian evolution doesn't contradict rebirth in any way. They fit very nicely together as teachings. But in this scientific view that I think most of us would probably agree with, that we've all evolved from these little creatures that lived, similarly, a very long time ago. Like there were these first life forms on the planet, right? And then they multiplied, and then they became like fish. There weren't people yet, right? They were like little tadpoles or whatever. I don't know all the scientific details, but you all know it's like they grew legs, right? The fish grew legs, and they walked onto the earth, and eventually, gradually, through just also cause and effect, sequences, endless sequences of cause and effect and reproduction, the traits very gradually change and evolve, and pretty soon we have humans. So I think it's pretty common understanding that all of us humans have evolved from the same ancestors. If we go, even human ancestors, you know, but you go back even further to like tadpoles. If you go back further, you start to include other species, which is nice, because we're talking about all beings. So if you see that we've evolved from the same being, that's like our great, 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 great grandparents were these tadpoles. Right? So in that way, we're like the same family. You know? It's like, this is a kind of conceptual thing, but so is Buddha's thing about rebirth. It's conceptual contemplation to warm up to this feeling of connectedness. And this is another one, that we're all like this one huge family, not just humans, but all sentient beings have the same ancestors. So we might feel like, well, we're such a distant, removed cousins or something, but still, we're family. We're family. So for me, that kind of works. It has a similar effect to the rebirth thing, putting aside whether or not we believe in these other kinds of relationships and past lives. So I invite you to check that out on your own. Contemplate our relationships through vast time and space. So that's the one that the Buddha recommends to generate loving kindness. Because kindness is part of the theory here, is that kindness is completely natural, part of everyone's heart for people that we're close to. There's some people we feel this like wish that they'd be happy without any effort at all. It might be just like one person, or it might even not be anybody right now, but sometime in our life we have felt that, right? And it's usually not just random people. It's usually people that we like have a strong connection with and that have benefited us. That's part of the thing here too. Those who have strongly benefited us, we naturally feel this reciprocal thing. So this contemplation is contemplating how everyone has benefited us in the distant past. And therefore we naturally, if we can relate to them in that way, as kind benefactors, then we naturally feel this kindness. It's not something we have to contrive. It's part of our being. We're naturally connected. And we're like this with everybody. You know, you could say Buddha nature feels this complete intimacy with all beings, but it's blocked by layers of conceptuality and distance, and like they're different from me, and you know, I don't know them, and so on. But our true nature is like already completely intimate with everyone. So it's kind of opening those gates of inherent connection. So if that doesn't work, this list of four things is coming from the Theravada text called The Path of Purification, where it's a lot of step-by-step kind of things by an old teacher, Buddhaghosa. And he says, try that one out. If it doesn't work, here's another one. And it, usually everything's taught in very particular orders, you know, like that's maybe the most effective, but if it doesn't work, think of the advantages of loving kindness. Okay, forget about these other, you know, people and how we're related for now. It doesn't work. So just think, well, when I feel this wish, actually, I feel really great. And you can test it out for yourself in just small ways. In meditation is a nice time because you can be very aware of your more subtle mind states and emotional states when you're sitting quietly. So in meditation, you can just generate that thought towards it. And generally, it's good to like towards particular people. When we say, may all beings be happy, we eventually work up to all beings, but it becomes so abstract that it's not so intimate, I think, at least to start with. So a particular person or even group of people, like may everyone in this room, I think that's okay too, be happy, be at ease. And if you kind of just like generate that thought, I find when I generate that thought, I feel at ease, actually. I feel better. If I'm kind of like dull or grumpy, it's uplifting. So that's an advantage. And the Buddha there's a whole sutra of like the 11 advantages of having thoughts of loving kindness, which didn't even write them all down, but it's basically one is comfortable and at ease. One sleeps well at night instead of like staying up thinking, that person, how dare they had said that to me. I'm going to have to work it out with them. Because, no, I just, may they be happy. Okay, well, I always fall asleep, but that's an interesting point. Sometimes we don't sleep because of this, right? Also, one is easily concentrated. So if one's trying to practice meditative concentration, in fact, that's how these are set up in this meditation manual called The Path of Purification. They're concentration objects to develop being really, really settled in Zazen. So when you have this buoyant light mind and heart of loving kindness, it's easier to settle into stillness of meditation. And check that out for yourself. I've been trying to experiment with that and finding it's true. Sometimes we're not settled because we're kind of thinking about other people and relationships and just temporarily turn it. May that being and all beings be happy. Our heart is just more at ease. And also maybe we'll have more friends if we're practicing kindness towards others. So if this still doesn't work, if it's like, I'm thinking about the advantages, but actually, right now I'm really enjoying this really energetic, juicy feeling of resentment and anger. I feel really alive. So I hear those advantages of loving kindness, but this one's really cooking now. We might unconsciously or unconsciously think that. In which case, because loving kindness is the antidote to anger, those are like the opposites. And it's said that kindness and anger cannot exist at the same time. This is one of those kind of dharmic teachings that you can test for yourself too. I think I can hold a little bit of each. You can try it. The Buddha says they cannot exist at the same time. So it's an antidote to anger or aversion. And so this next one is, if we're angry at someone else or a group of others, to actually kind of break down the others that we're angry at into their elements. Like break down the kind of mentally, these are all kind of conceptual exercises, but they have an effect. So this is like deconstructing, basically, the person. We have a lot of, you know, Zen teachings start to get into this kind of thing, so, right? We see, it's one of the classic important teachings of the Buddha, that me is not this, like, you know, solid, fixed entity with an essence of me-ness, right? It's there's no essential I. When we look more closely, we can mentally deconstruct this person into, for example, five aggregates is a common one. This person, what we call this person, is this form, bodily form, different feelings constantly changing, perceptions and conceptions of the world constantly changing, karmic tendencies, formations coming and going, and even consciousness itself is arising and ceasing dependent on objects. So none of these things are a fixed entity. And that collection of these five aggregates working together very harmoniously convinces us very easily that it's not just a collection of five aggregates of experience coming and going. It's me and you. And I'm angry at you. I'm not angry at that set of constantly changing five aggregates. I'm angry at you. So we start to deconstruct the other person, actually. And you know, we have stories that people have maybe heard the story about the boat. Like you're out of the, I don't know where the story comes from. Maybe it's in the sutras. But you're like drifting around happily at sea on your little rubber raft, sunbathing, and on this kind of speedboat is coming straight towards you. Hey, stop! Don't you see me? You get, you know, really upset, and then it kind of runs into you and damages your raft, and you're so angry. I can't believe that person would do that. And then you look as it goes by the other direction, and there's nobody at the wheel. It's like a runaway boat that somebody fell off of at full speed. So just this image is quite wonderful. As soon as you see that there's nobody driving it, it's actually your anger. Just maybe you're still upset that the boat damaged your boat, but actually your anger at the person who did this to you dissipates. It's like there's no one to blame. It's just a phenomena that happened, right? According to conditions, we could say, well, they shouldn't have fallen off the boat, but you can see where the metaphor leads, right? When we see that it's impersonal, that it's just causes and conditions, it dissipates our anger and blame. So we can do that with a person. See, this person who I'm angry at is just a set of conditions themselves. They're just a body and mind experiences of constantly changing five aggregates, or in the text of this, or you can just use the physical ones, the four elements of earth, wind, fire, and water. That person is just four elements that have come together in this particular combination that looks like solidity on the outside and liquidity moving around the inside, but actually it's just four impersonal physical elements that make up a human body. So these are these deconstructing meditations that the Buddha offered from the earliest days, to help us get over our attachments and aversions to the conglomerates we call me and you. So we may be able to deconstruct a person that we're angry at, and then be able to maybe apply these earlier ones. Like now, may this collection of five skandhas, this collection of body and mind conditions, may that collection experience happiness. Maybe that's easier for someone who's really, like, annoying us. So, if that still doesn't work, there's one last one, which is sort of, I was surprised to hear. I thought, this is nice. This makes sense to me. Is the particular person that you're not feeling loving kindness towards, you either give them a gift or receive a gift from them. Isn't that great? So sweet, you know? And you think, well, what about receiving? You should just give a gift. But actually, even receiving a gift from someone, you start to warm up to them, right? I thought, this is just great psychology from 2,500 years ago. you know, well, let me just, I don't really want to give them a gift, but let me force myself to do it. Yeah, I just, and Buddha, I think, mentioned some examples. You just, anything, even a kind word, right? You give them, and often, even if they're angry at you, if you do, it's kind of like enacting some kindness, even if we don't feel it. They usually like feel a little bit, you know, maybe they feel like, yeah, great, thanks a lot. But, no, I don't know. Maybe still we might feel like, well, I gave it. But they might lighten up a little bit. We might feel like, well, that just like connected our relationship. Or to receive something, we might be like, I'm not going to receive anything from them as a kind of protest. You know, people do this kind of thing sometimes. Then I'll feel like, you know, if I receive their gift, maybe that means that I accept them or something. So no, just like receive it. And it's actually, and it helps to make them, it lightens them up a little bit too. We have in this Bodhisattva precepts text that we're studying. We haven't gotten to this part yet, but one of the, you know, there's thousands of Bodhisattva precepts within these three collective precepts that we've been talking about. And one of the many is if you're invited to some like event, like a dinner party or something, the Bodhisattva doesn't refuse. It gives some clauses, I think. Like you can, if you have something else to do, like if you have to meditate or something, you can say, I actually have a meditation period now, or some other virtuous activity. But if you have no real reason other than that, just go. Because it benefits them. You know? And I think in that case, I think Asanga talks about it like, for them to make, their gift increases their merit or their happiness. And for them to fully enact the gift, you have to receive it. So it's for their happiness of being able to offer the gift to you that you receive it. Quite interesting. I think that's the principle too of like in the old tradition in India of the monastics being supported by the lay people. We might have some feeling like that seems really selfish and they're not, you know, they should take care of themselves. But when the Buddha teaches this, he says, you monks have to remember this, and hopefully the lay people remember this too, that you receiving these gifts is an offering to them. And if you go to Asian countries where they practice this, you really feel that. The lay people are like so excited about making these offerings because they feel happy. And the monks maybe aren't as excited actually. They maybe feel a little bit of like, could feel a little shame or a little bit like extra responsibility. Wow, like they're just giving me this. I gotta really like get it together and practice. But the givers just feel unreserved happiness at giving. So sort of reverse of our maybe intuitive, our first sense of what giving and receiving. So these are four methods to generate this wish, may all beings be happy. And I came across this from a kind of Zen perspective. This is Shodo Harada Roshi, a contemporary Japanese teacher who teaches in both Japan and America. Various San Francisco Zen Center elder teachers are students of Shodo Harada Roshi. Somebody asked, this is question and answers, somebody asks, how in Zen training can we be touched by life? How can we gain that tender heart of compassion? And so this kind of Zen style of answer, instead of these methods for developing the wish that all beings be happy, he says, people who seriously enter Zen training are all aiming towards this particular goal, the possibility of enlightenment. You might say, wait a second. He's a Rinzai Zen teacher, by the way. But however we might think of that, when we sit down to practice, we try not to obsess about some future goal or anything in the future at all. We just sit. But in order to get up early in the morning and get ourselves over here day after day and keep the practice going, I think we do have a goal. It's okay to have a goal. It's just not a self-centered, obsessive, gaining kind of goal. We want all beings to be happy. We vow to realize Buddha's way to benefit all beings. So this is how he's putting it very straightforwardly. So in order to become Buddha's way and save all beings, people who are trying to be compassionate, trying to be in the moment, trying to be loving, trying to be present without looking for something outside themselves, come to Zen training because they felt the need to be able to develop in a certain way. They have found that their ability to feel love and compassion has been frustrated because they do not know that source of mind that allows one to fully express these things. Zen teaching aims towards this realizing the nature of mind. People want kindness and compassion, but no matter how much they try, they can't find them at least as fully as they'd like to. But what about the experience of mind where these things are supposed to come from? How can we have a direct encounter with that place when we don't know what it is or how to express it? It's like having an itch on your foot, but being able to scratch only the outside of your shoe. What do you do when you want to be more compassionate, when you want to be here in the present and be able to express that tender-heartedness you feel but cannot do it? How do you go about learning this? So, when you don't know where to find that place from where this compassion comes forth, this heart, this presence comes from, then you need a strong kind of tool to find it. And that's what Zen training offers. So the kind of rigorous, just sitting practice is to touch this heart and open this place from where the kindness and compassion naturally pour forth. He says, one monk who was training here at our temple left to care for a friend who was dying of AIDS. His compassion was opening from his Zen practice, so he went to take care of this friend. After the friend died, the monk stayed to help another AIDS patient and then another. But then the third AIDS patient went completely crazy and had to be taken to a mental hospital, and the monk could not handle it. He had all this training, all this preparation, and yet he found himself in a situation where he couldn't hold on to that empty center. Because he realized that he needed more training, he had not dug in far enough to fully develop that compassion, heart, and presence in this really difficult situation, he returned to come do sesshin. This is one way to look at our meditation retreats, sesshin, is to just open this heart of compassion. And it's kind of intense and difficult way to do that, but this is a kind of explanation for that's what it's about, actually. That's why this experience of clear mind is so important. When the clear mind is realized, when these feelings of love and compassion come forth truly, naturally, and spontaneously out of this clear mind, then they're not something that has to be chosen or cultivated. Love rather than aversion, compassion rather than narrow-mindedness will evolve naturally from a state of clarity, which brings forth the wisdom to express those things in the moment. With that experience of clear mind, there will not be even a thought about whether this is compassion, whether this is love, whether this is tender-heartedness. That clarified mind from which these things come forth naturally must be realized and reached before we can begin expressing those emotions truly and fully from their source. Otherwise, we're acting from a conception of what compassion is that rather than from true compassion. And over again, to come back and touch the source, the nature of mind. So that's the streamlined Zen version with, you know, we have some methods in Zen too, but style of just sit, but just sit opening to this heart of compassion. And even Dogen quotes his own teacher saying, the Zazen of the Buddhas and ancestors, the practice of meditation in the Zen tradition is filled with this loving compassion. And that's how it's different from other types of meditation that might be just get really concentrated, period. So any comments, questions, doubts, concerns, affirmations? Yes.
Hi.
What's your name?
Suchitra.
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 Yes.
What's it mean?
Good
news. Yes.
Today I had an encounter with a person, and it required me to be a beneficial friend, and to a person who she did not know that she was a beneficial friend. So it was, she was suffering, she was younger, and it was so to the point of what you're talking about. But the whole thing oddly makes me think of that moment, if anybody saw American Hustle, when she gives that kiss, they're right in the middle of the fight.
They're
having a huge argument, and she just kisses her.
Right?
And it just stops the movie. You know? I mean, even though that's not a perfect example, it's one of those things where sometimes the most unexpected thing just stops the dynamic. And, you know, giving someone something when they think you're their enemy,
Yeah, so it worked for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to work, but I definitely saw her lack of skill and how unsettled she was and how she was reaching for any weapon she could grab. It wasn't for me, it was for someone else, and it was not going to work. But she didn't expect kindness.
Yeah,
That was the last thing she expected, so it sort of stopped.
Yeah, how wonderful to shift the energy, which is very hard to do because we get stuck in an energetic rut.
And she had, you know, I have no dynamic with her at all, so I felt completely, I wasn't plugged into it. I could step outside. Although, what I did notice that was, I don't even know what to think about it, is when it first started happening with someone else, I was just adrenalized inside. It was like I was quivering and shaking and just felt really not physically, just being
cold. Yeah, exactly.
Being afraid, get away from it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why this is so hard to do something, because we're, the adrenaline's flowing, and the last thing we're thinking of is just like being really like open and kind.
I know.
It really takes practice.
And you don't know if it's going to come around
and Thanks for mentioning that. And as you were speaking, it reminded me that something like this happened to me yesterday too. Of somebody was actually giving me a really hard time. And, you know, that they have somebody who has some like difficulties around this. It's happened before, and it wasn't based on anything really. But even though it wasn't based on anything, the adrenaline still got going. And it was like, and I couldn't get a word in there. It was one of those things. And it didn't end up good. He stormed away. And then I was getting ready to, then I was talking to some other people, and then on my way out of that place, I passed by him, and he was talking with somebody else, and I just thought, my feeling is like, I'm just like, all that's gone, and I just like deep bow to him, and he deeply bowed back, and it was just like, it was like as if nothing had happened, almost like bizarre. I think he was maybe like, oh, now I'm going to have to like come back and apologize next time and work this out. And still, who knows what will happen next time. But I think it was just like, let's resolve it right now. And it's silently like that. And it was a beautiful moment for me. Yeah. Oh, yes.
And it really is that thing, if you get as many chances
yes.
to go over,
yes. Right?
And if people can just do that, not like, oh, instead of building on the shame of, oh, I handled that so badly,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, that's the bodhisattva way.
And you forgot to kiss me goodbye.
Yeah. Yep. Over and over again, we just keep failing and getting up and doing it again endlessly. That's our path, yeah. Any other last question?
Well, this is a sort of an ongoing question. Here came to a class that Chuck and I teach over at Costa Nova, which is a continuation school here in town. And many of those kids, as you saw yesterday, are determined not to fall into the same kind of dysfunctional patterns.
By the way, that happened yesterday too, but it wasn't one of those kids.
No.
But that was interesting too.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you suggest us? I mean, I think our presence there helps them a lot and gives them an example or a model, whatever, to the extent that we can do it with them. But then, how do they look for and find people in their own lives that are not so that they can trust and turn to and find that kind of loving compassion?
Yeah. Yeah.
On like a regular basis.
Uh-huh.
Just
yeah.
When they're getting high.
Yeah. Well, you and Chuck offering that, I think you're Kalyana Mitras for them just by being there. And they feel that, I think.
Yesterday, so.
And so, I got to be there for them. Mm-hmm. And they keep coming back because they appreciate, right? So that's the main thing, because it's hard without going into their lives to set them up like that. But I remember two of those kids said how they together, when one of them's feeling down, they're like good friends for each other, and they say, let's go off to the woods.
Yeah.
And this is where we find refuge, is in nature.
Yeah.
And they were like, they seem like spiritual friends for each other, those two. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because she was saying that's what I do when we're talking about mindfulness. It's a mindfulness class for high school kids. Yeah. And I find it easier to do that out in nature where everything's simpler. And but I take my friend with me. Mm-hmm. And we encourage each other like that.
And that is, you're right, that's a
wonderful
example for the whole class.
Mhm. So, yeah. And Sangha is great. You know, I think whatever kind of, some kind of spiritual community, whether it's coming to an actual practice place or just in your daily life. But we kind of set this up here for like spiritual communion. Like the Saturday Sangha Day. It's like the just community work day. We don't do any, well, we do a period of meditation if people want to come, but then we just like do stuff, like plant a lawn and just take care of the practice place together and just being together in this wholesome way to take care of a place for practicing kindness and presence. So how simple and beautiful. And it's always everyone's always welcome. It's an open door. You're welcome to have some tea if you'd like. Now, and if there's any feelings of ease and well-being that we sometimes call merit, we offer it to all beings. May they enjoy it and be happy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.